This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Wakey Junkions, it's time for another episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com.
This is the weekly cult and exploitation film guest that is so good, it will keep you awake at night. And it has to be fattening. But the keeping you awake so that you can eat more food that has to be fattening or something like that. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me as per usual is my friend and co-host. He is a novelist. He's a screenwriter. I can verify that because I've seen Doctor Strange. Yeah.
Finally.
He's also a lieutenant in Megaforce. I can't confirm that, but that's what he tells me. See Robert Carson.
You have seen the confirmation. You have seen the signed photo
from the Blu-ray.
Commander.
Oh, you mean of the... Yeah, absolutely.
You've seen the verification that I am, in fact, a commander in Megaforce.
That's true.
Or a lieutenant in Megaforce.
And if you would like verification that this is, in fact, a podcast, our back catalog is on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really... like the podcast, like you, anytime we miss a week, you have nightmares about it, or anytime the show is late, you find yourself waking in a cold sweat. What you ought to do is, first of all, rearrange your priorities immediately. And secondly, become a patron of the show, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. For as little as $4 a month, you get access to a ton of bonus content that Cargill and I record just for patrons. We just did a review recently of John Wick 2. For Junk Food a la Mode.
The dose.
We also do mailbags. We have top five lists. We do a lot of cool stuff for patrons. And right now the patronage is growing, and we really appreciate that. And if you would please, even if you can't become a patron, go to iTunes, rate and review us, because we want to move up that list. I know it shouldn't bother me, and it's a petty thing.
It really
thing.
Shouldn't bother
me. It shouldn't at all, but I want to move up that list. I want to be on that list. A good damn it. Hey, speaking of things that'll keep you awake at night, we are beginning a new series, a new mini series on Junk Food Cinema for the month of March.
Of one of my favorite oddball subgenres from a very particular period in history.
Yes, we are the subway of genres. We like the subgenres a lot. We like the footlong weirdo subs of cinema, and this is one of Cargill's favorite subgenres, and it is.
We're calling it March Madness because it's March, and that's what you call everything. Like in October, Oktoberfest at the end of everything.
And it's funny because Cargill refers to every sport as sports ball, so it's funny that we went with a sports reference.
But we're going to talk about psychic thriller and horror films.
Yeah.
We're talking about this post-Carrie, strong Stephen King era where there were several movies a year that dealt with people with psychic powers.
Psychic killer, kiss to see.
In fact, I was just talking about these with my co-writer Scott Derrickson the other day, because we were talking about how science fiction and fantasy tend not to blend very well. That it's very hard to get right. That you put aliens in a movie with an archaeologist going around to ancient ruins and looking for religious artifacts, and all of a sudden everybody just rejects it. And you have a bunch of times where science and fantasy just don't quite go together. And then you get something like the psychic film, which is technically, as it's presented in most of these movies, science fiction. But they function like fantasy films. These are superhero movies. These are people with powers being subjected to these weird things. And the interesting thing about this time is because it was such a weird era of filmmaking, you get a lot of cross-pollination of genres in these films. And so what we're going to talk about this month are a number of films that take the idea of psychic powers and then do really crazy cool shit with them. And that starts this week with one of the best of the lot. Definitely the one with the greatest cast that we're going to talk about this month. Probably the greatest cast of a psychic movie of all time. Dreamscape.
Alex Gardner has a unique talent. And even he doesn't know what it can do.
No one has ever done it before. No one has even conceived of doing it before.
Going into another person's dream. You might have deceived that, David.
He is about to enter a world that no one has ever seen before. The world of your dreams.
I can see you're going to be a real challenge to work with.
Oh, wait a minute, Doctor. I haven't agreed to anything yet.
There's somebody in my dreams.
Who?
An awful, ugly monster.
This kid is being eaten alive and nobody gives a damn.
Whatever his demon is, you have to help him face it.
There's nobody there.
Are you sure, Alex? He's always here.
But Alex will make a discovery more frightening than any dream.
What's going on?
I had to let you know you're in danger.
You want my secrets?
I just want some advice.
I'm afraid he has to be killed.
And now, his only way out is to go back in to the Dreamscape. Dennis Quaid, Kate Capshaw, Dreamscape. When you close your eyes, the adventure begins.
Now, if I were to say to you, gentle listener, we're talking about a movie from 1984 in which something in people's dreams keeps killing them, what movie would you think I was referring
Dreamscape.
To? No.
Dreamscape.
You would not immediately
say Dreamscape. No, because the Dreamscape is the movie with the guy that has knives for a hand.
Yes.
From 1984.
Okay, I feel like we're maybe crossing a few wires here, but that's what's so bonkers bizarre about Dreamscape, is that it came out the same year as A Nightmare on Elm Street. And they both have instances where someone is basically being hunted in their dreams by a killer, and it's causing real-world death.
Yeah.
And it's not really the first time a killer in your dreams is a concept that's been fathomed by either film. I mean, we were talking before we turned on the microphones about Brain Scan.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and even before that, like the very first villain Doctor Strange ever fights in the comic, in Strange Tales 110, is Nightmare. A entity from another dimension, the dream dimension, who controls people's nightmares, feeds off it, and is constantly trying to invade our world, and can actually kill people in their dreams.
Dormammu, we've come to reference Doctor Strange.
That is, and it is something that years, 30 years before Freddy Krueger, you had 20 years before Freddy Krueger, you had Nightmare. Mm-hmm. And that idea then permeated, and you find, various films and books dealing with dreams in this manner, and culminating in these two fantastic films in 1984.
Yes. And the thing, by the way, I have to, before we go any further, I've decided that Dormammu, I've come to drink, is what I'm going to say every time I go up to the bar and I'm out drinking and I order the same thing. That being said, Dreamscape is a movie that I actually saw for the first time. I was doing a project one year where I was watching 12 different movies that came out in 1984 that I hadn't seen right before I turned 30. So I was trying to like catch up on all these movies and see if they like meant something to me as I turned 30. Dreamscape was really interesting because the more I watched it, the more I realized it was like two films I love. One is obviously A Nightmare on Elm Street. The other is Inception.
Yeah.
Gamblers, if you're out there, because in this movie, Dennis Quaid starts off as a gambler, I will encourage you to put money on the fact that Jonathan Nolan has seen and enjoys very much the movie Dreamscape.
Oh, yeah. No, it is. Inception is very much an evolution of what Dreamscape starts with.
Yes.
And they play around with science in just kind of a very similar way. Inception is pure sci-fi, where it's like, this is just a computer thing that we can hook up and give you the right amount of drugs and we can do this. In Dreamscape, you need psychics to do it. And you've got to have someone with psychic power to begin with that then gets augmented through science and learns how to do this. And man, is it fucking bonkers.
It really is. Now, in terms of plot, I mean, we've mentioned already that we have this character, Alex Gardner, played by Dennis Quaid, who...
Quaid!
Start the movie. You're the fucking star of it.
First and only person cast. This is not one of those situations like movies we've talked about in the past where it was like this person was considered, but they backed out, and this person. This was apparently written for Dennis Quaid. 1984 Dennis Quaid. Apparently this movie was written for. That just kind of blows my mind.
And he's great in it.
Oh, he's fantastic in this movie. And he is a psychic, but he is using his powers to win at horse racing more than anything else, which of course he runs afoul of the IRS and a local mob. And so he ends up getting contacted and kind of shanghaied into working on a project by a former colleague of his, played by
Max von Sydow.
Now, in this movie, Cargill mentioned the cast. We have, of course, Dennis Quaid. We have 1984 apparently being her biggest year, Kate Capshaw.
Yep.
And we have the dueling banjos of old white guys.
Christopher Plummer.
And Max von Sydow.
And Max von Sydow. And we also have, we've got Eddie Albert. And yes. We have what I consider the third leg of the great tripod of amazing villain roles by David Patrick Kelly. And in fact, this is not his most iconic role, but this I feel like is his deepest villain role.
This is his best role that doesn't involve him clinking glass bottles together.
Or a guy coming back from the dead. The Crow.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Those are the three great.
Wait, David Patrick Kelly? Okay. I see what
you're
saying.
There ain't no coming back. Okay. This is the really real world. There ain't no coming back.
I thought you meant David Patrick Kelly comes back from the dead in The Crow. And it was throwing me off because I was trying to think of a movie where David Patrick Kelly comes back from the grave. And I was like, when Schwarzenegger drops Sully and says, "I said I'd kill you last I lied," he doesn't like bounce back up, does he? Am I remembering that movie? Dormammu, another drink, please.
Yeah. David Patrick Kelly is one of those guys that all of you know who he is. If you hear his name, odds are you don't recognize it.
Yes.
But he, the minute you see his face, you're like, oh, it's that dude.
Yeah.
He was in John Wick as the body collector. Because at this point, he is now one of those legendary cult actors that you just get to come in and do these things.
He's in a very underappreciated Walter Hill film called Last Man Standing with Bruce Willis.
Yes. And underappreciated, we have a argument on whether it's underappreciated.
Oh, you think a lot of people love it as much as I do? That's good. Okay. It's good to know that you disagree that it's underappreciated and is therefore overappreciated.
Yeah, but he's in Walter Hill's greatest film of all time,
which is The Warriors.
And here he's really fantastic.
Yes.
He just really, really chews up scenery here in the best way. He plays this villain. The wonderful thing about this villain is that he is so fucking full of himself.
Oh my God.
And talks in a bullying way, trying to needle Dennis Quaid, who could not give a shit.
Yeah.
Like there's a one way rivalry going on where David Patrick Kelly is just like trying to measure dicks. And Dennis Quaid is like, all right, yours is bigger. We don't even have to look. Like, I'm fine. Whatever. Just go do your thing, dude. I don't care.
David Patrick Kelly, you need to bring a barrel of guacamole for the size of the chip on his shoulder throughout the whole movie. And meanwhile, Dennis Quaid apparently went to the Jeff Bridges School of Everything. Because his whole personality, like, there's literally a point in this movie, you watch it, he's going into a bathroom right after he's been awakened by his former mentor, Dr. Novotny, played by Max von Sydow, where he has this smug look on his face where he just closes his eyes real tight and just kind of nods like whatever, that looks exactly like fucking Jeff Bridges. And I'm like, oh, okay, you're a fan, clearly. So you're right, the dynamic between the two of them is really interesting because David Patrick Kelly plays the resident psychic at this facility that Novotny's in charge of, and he's doing research into the idea that someone who is psychic can project themselves into another person's dream with the help of the monitors and the technology.
And then manipulate the dream, and through that, help them work through the anxieties that are only being expressed in their dream state.
Sigmund Freud's Inception.
Yeah, it's like, this all starts out, this is one of the interesting things about how this is constructed, is it all starts out like as interesting sci-fi that makes sense as science. Like, it's not one of those programs where you're like, well, they're just developing this terrible thing and why would anyone go along? And it's like, no, this has a very real practical purpose and it's really great science.
And that's what's crazy about pretty much all the films we're going to cover in this series so far. We do have a fourth slot that hasn't been chosen yet. But if you follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, we have listed the first three movies we're covering in this series. And I was thinking about it, all of them have that. Yeah. All of them have this thing where they are trying to use science to rein in what is basically magic.
Yeah, and that's what fascinates me about the whole psychic subgenre.
Yeah.
Is that's essentially what it is. Like, as soon as you tell the audience, I can do mind shit, like, all of a sudden things like mind bullets and people's heads just spontaneously exploding and 15-year-old girls communicating with hordes of locusts totally makes sense.
And of course, the fourth movie will just be John Travolta in Phenomena, correct?
Do-do-do-do-do.
Phenomena?
Do-do-do-do.
Nope. No, it won't be. Spoiler alert, it's cancer.
No. We are only doing one phenomenon.
The movie and the twist.
This
cancer.
This month. And I can't wait to
Holy
talk about
shit,
that.
Holy shit. I'm sorry, I just realized that. We would have had two movies called Phenomena.
Yeah, no, because you
didn't
are
think about that.
Because you're thinking of the American cut, Creepers, which we will talk about in the Phenomena episode, as opposed to the European cut, which is Phenomena. So we're doing Phenomena this month.
We would sound really pretentious right now if we weren't talking about Creepers / Phenomena,
which it's fucking amazing.
Which is great. It is a great movie, but it's impossible to sound pretentious when you're talking about Argento's most Fulciest film. Meanwhile, Dreamscape.
Stargrove.
Yeah.
Tango.
Cash.
So Dreamscape is it. So we start off with this guy who's, as you said, is shanghaied into being here. And then he really gets into it. And he's like, holy shit, going into people's dreams and helping them out is kind of fucking great.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's this very weird subplot going on that has nothing to do with the movie until the end.
Yeah.
Like, it is, and it's one of those things where it's like, this is clearly coming around. But the president is having nightmares.
Yeah, that's actually the opening scene of the movie. And this is, I want to touch on this when comparing this movie to A Nightmare on Elm Street. A Nightmare on Elm Street has the more striking, iconically horrifying imagery. But I think Dreamscape is scary on a completely different level, because the things that happen in people's nightmares in Dreamscape are part of the collective unconscious. They are archetypes. Every bad dream that everybody talks about, whether it's I'm falling, a family member's in danger, and I can't do anything about it. Like, the bare bones of the most basic things that scare us in our nightmares, that multiple people have reported having nightmares about, are the things that get touched upon in Dreamscape, which makes those sequences, maybe they're not as creepy as Freddy Krueger, you know, killing someone on the ceiling, but you know that kind of dream, and you've had that kind of dream, and you have an emotional response when you see other people having those dreams, because you remember what it was like to have those dreams.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, like, that in terms of which is the better scary movie, you know, clearly Nightmare on Elm Street is terrifying. It is one of Wes Craven's masterpieces. This, the horror in this feels very Twilight Zone. Like, this feels like, this is, I don't want to say it feels like a Twilight Zone movie, because to a lot of people that seems like an insult, but instead it has the hallmarks of the type of things that Twilight Zone was playing around with, and then elevates them and does really great stuff with it. I love the interaction of all the characters here. I love how it leads to this horror. I love how the science is developed to try to help a guy deal with his anxiety that his wife is sleeping around on him.
Yeah.
And then going into that dream and watching, you know, how fucked up that dream is. This guy is having these dreams every night that has him ending up out on his lawn screaming into the darkness, and the dream is that he's, you know, walking in and finding his brother fucking his wife, and then his two best friends are under the bed because they ran under the bed when they heard him coming, and they're doing it in front of the kids, and behind the curtain is the gardener
and
the mailman and the priest.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is the type of stupid anxieties that people deal with. This is how they express it in their dreams. And this guy starts really, Dennis Quaid's character really starts enjoying going into people's dreams and helping them, which leads to a great centerpiece where this kid who's troubled with night terrors, he goes into the kid's dream to help him through a horror movie.
Also, I don't know if this is the first movie to do this. And actually, before we get into that, a moment of sheathe your tweets, if I may. We said Brain Scan. Brainstorm is the movie we were referring to.
Oh, see, I thought it was called Brainstorm.
Brain Scan is the one with Edward Furlong. Brainstorm is the one prior to 1984 with a similar idea.
Yeah.
to this, not to Brain Scan. Yeah, I don't know. I can't say for certain whether Dreamscape was the first movie to do this, but there is a conceit in this movie, a delivery system for creepiness that you see in modern horror all the fucking time now. And that's like, oh, what you drawing, Billy? And then you just see the drawings and they're progressively darker and creepier, and it really is unsettling.
Yeah, I don't think this is the first one to do it, but they do it well.
Yeah, they do it very well. And then it made me realize how often you see that in modern horror now.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, no, it's creepy kids is a popular trope.
Yeah, so either they're drawing on paper or maybe on the walls, just drawing creepy shit, and it really bothers. Oh, wait a minute. Dormammu, another beer. So we're going along. He decides that he wants to help this kid who's having these recurring nightmares about this monster he calls the Snake Man. And that sequence, holy shit, do I love that sequence. Because oh, yeah. He goes in to help the kid, and at first, you know, it's very much like there's a knock at the door, and he's trying to console the kid. There's no one there. Then the snake guy comes through, and the Snake Man is actually a really interesting combination of puppets and editing, and then stop motion animation, it was like Harryhausen claymation for just like brief moments. And the moment that really gets me about that sequence is they're running out of the room away from the Snake Man, and the kid goes, "Oh, that's my dad, but he never helps." And there's a man sitting at a breakfast table with a newspaper, and he just goes, "Little bastard's right." So they run past him, but then as soon as they hit the stairs, you hear that dad being murdered by the Snake Man. And it is bone chilling.
Yeah. No, that's a sequence I was specifically talking about. It feels like an episode of Tales from the Dark Side or The Twilight Zone from the 80s. Like, it's just so dark and twisted and bent.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very bent version of reality, and it's that sequence is so well done. By the way, we have not mentioned yet the director.
We haven't. Joseph Rubin is a returning Junk Food Cinema alum.
Yeah.
Because his very next movie was The Stepfather, right?
Yes,
after this.
One that we love.
So much.
And we've referenced many times. He would go on from this. Although this would be the last movie he would write. He would do a number of more successful films over the years.
Sleeping with the Enemy, True Believer, Money Train.
Good Son. But
yes, the Good
his
Son.
Two best films are these crazy fucking junk food genre films he did in 84 and 87, Dreamscape and The Stepfather. I actually like Dreamscape a lot more than The Stepfather, as much as I love The Stepfather.
Interesting.
Yeah, this movie pushes all my buttons just right. Like, Max von Sydow, for one thing. Anything Max von Sydow shows up in, I'm fucking in. Then you get menaced by, like, Christopher Plummer.
And this is the part that takes Dreamscape to another level for me. I know we've mentioned that there is this kind of B story that's running through but doesn't really connect until the end. But what that B story does is it makes Dreamscape feel like a Cronenberg movie.
Yeah, because all of a sudden it goes from just being a horror science fiction film to being a political thriller because, oh, guess what? This menacing piece of shit David Patrick Kelly character is working along with the government, and this program's being funded by the government to be used to create dream assassins.
Yes, and that's what's so crazy is you have these sort of body horror elements where people are literally dying in their dreams, and there's some fucked up shit happening in the dreams. At one point, hey, Kate Capshaw, I know it's 1984 and all, but maybe you don't do more movies where someone's still beating heart gets ripped out of their chest, because it happens in this movie too.
Yeah, no, this movie has the unfortunate thing that it hits a lot of buttons with a lot of classic movies that would come out alongside it.
Yeah.
So it feels like an imitation of the era when really they were doing it. It was parallel thinking.
Yeah.
And there's so much parallel thinking
there
in this
really
movie.
Is. There really and then it's like once you start getting the government involved with psychics, it is impossible not to draw parallels to Scanners.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Yeah. In fact, when I watched this a couple weeks ago, I then was like, fuck it. You know what? I'm going to watch Scanners 2 again. Just followed it right up.
Whoa. You're going to watch Scanners as well again, or you watched Scanners 2?
Scanners 2.
Scanners 2. The New Order.
I'm so glad we clarified that.
Yeah.
That is way worse.
Yeah, no, because I'd recently seen Scanners again, and so I was like, you know what, I haven't watched since it came out, Scanners 2, and then I found out why I hadn't watched Scanners 2 in so long. you'd love it. It has Score.
I've seen it. I've seen it.
It has Score in the box, which makes you pull your hair out and scream.
Oh, meaty trumpets. You can take your meaty trumpets and shove them up your ass. Oh, man. No, there is no better way to get me to turn off a movie short of killing a dog faster than if I hear one goddamn meaty orchestra. No, thank you.
But so here's the thing about this though, and here's what I'm going to argue in point of history. As much as it has this parallel thinking going on, I think without Dreamscape, we don't get Nightmare 3.
We don't, and I'll tell you exactly why we don't get Nightmare 3. Because one of the writers on this movie is David Lowery, who ends up writing and directing Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
It's the marriage, these two films that came out in 1984. Yes. He then goes on
and
creates the merging of those universes.
It's like we compare notes before we start recording, but we don't.
We don't.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I absolutely 100% agree. Because this movie isn't just this movie takes that concept that was at the very end of Nightmare on Elm Street, which is that let's go into the dream and fight this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stop being terrorized and trying to stay awake. And no point in this movie, the only time it's ever suggested that anyone is trying to stay awake to avoid something in their dreams is the little kid. Every other approach is let's go in and figure out what's going on. So this is that really practical, meeting head on of the monster in the dream, which is exactly what Dream Warriors is.
And the final act of this movie is Dennis Quaid realizing, getting the lesson from David Patrick Kelly. Hey, this is a dream, asshole. You can do whatever you want here. Haven't you figured that out yet?
Yeah.
And then once he figures it out, then he starts playing dirty.
Yeah.
And because this is the first time we've seen this kind of battle, it's very simple compared to the type of stuff we would later see in the Nightmare series.
Well, because it's not... I feel like so much of the Nightmare on Elm Street sequels are about the visual gags.
And
that's really not what this...
And
this,
the jokes.
Yeah, because this movie has... what is that thing that you don't find a lot in Nightmare sequel? Oh, characters.
Except for 3.
3 has the best characters of any of the sequels. And, I will grant you that.
And, the Wes Craven's Return, Freddy Krueger or Freddy
New Nightmare?
New Nightmare, yeah.
You know what's funny? I would argue the characters in Dream Warriors are better than Heather Logenkamp playing herself as a character.
You really don't like
her. She's terrible. I'm sorry. She's not a good actress.
I love her.
But that being said, I mean, you get Larry Fishburne and Yaphet Kotto in the same fucking movie.
I know.
Like, come on, man. Come on, Dream Warriors 100%.
Dream Warriors fucking amazing.
Yeah, so this movie's characters and the fact that we watch Dennis Quaid, who is extremely charming in this movie, come around from being that rapscallion and that outsider who's really only in it for himself, is forced to be here, to someone who really cares about this kid, who's really invested, and
who falls in love with Kate Capshaw.
Falls in love with Kate Capshaw and basically dream rapes her, which is
Seduces her. This is not the Phantom, okay?
Okay, but
this is not like give me his body when you're done. He goes into her dream and she's like, oh shit, I'm having a dream about this dude, unaware that he's actually him, and then she feels violated, as well she should, because he went into her dream and he does violate her in that way. But calling it dream rape is going down a path that I don't think this movie does.
I can dream about you if I can't obtain consent.
Doo-doo-doo.
And I also love that this isn't the Phantom. If you've been listening to this show, is a phrase that you should go, and be super uncomfortably comfortable with.
If you are one of the newer people to our show,
go back and listen to our Phantom episode.
Yeah, because Phantom's a little rapey.
You know what? And that is that is one of our most downloaded episodes. Whenever I look at the non-current episodes that are getting the most downloads, the Phantom is always number one. So I don't know what that says about our audience or says about our ability to analyze that movie. I don't know. But it is a weird thing that I keep singing, like, oh, another 400 downloads for the
Phantom.
There's
probably
episode.
A Phantom fan forum somewhere that they're just like, have you listened to this review? Like, they're still just hanging out in the forums, yelling at each other, talking about how great the Phantom is.
Okay, is fan and forum also spelled with a PH? I hope it is.
Probably.
I really hope the Phantom fan forum is spelled with PHs across the board. I hope that's what's happening. So this movie that we were talking about, digging into the potatoes a little bit, sorry about that. Yeah, that final showdown, when you realize that David Patrick Kelly isn't just a guy who's fucking with people to remain a number one psychic at this facility, but he's literally a dream assassin.
He's a dream assassin, and he's an 80s mall ninja. Like, he is.
That's exactly what I was... Yeah, there's a moment where Christopher Plummer comes in. Christopher Plummer is the perfect...
Oh, yeah.
The perfect flavor of greasy in this movie. I love it so much. There's a moment where he comes into David Patrick Kelly's room at the facility, and I remember, it's been a while since I've seen this movie, and I remember watching it this time and being like, there's a fuck ton of Bruce Lee shit on the wall, there's Ninja Star, like, what is going on?
And then later in the dream sequence, he's like, you guys ever see Enter the Dragon? I've seen it 6 times.
It's like, oh, cute, okay, you think you're a ninja, I get it now. And then he's got, like, nunchucks with spikes at the end of them that just look like some kind of dominatrix toy. Like, I'm not sure
it's the perfect, like, mall ninja shit.
Mall ninja. Like,
it is mall ninja shit. It's just like, you know what would be badass? Nunchucks. You know what would be even more badass than nunchucks? Nunchucks with spikes on the end.
Let's play a quick game. I'm gonna throw a name out at you. Mall ninja or real ninja, okay? Michael Dudikoff.
Real ninja.
Okay. Jonathan Brandis and Sidekicks.
Mall ninja.
Okay. All of the surf ninjas.
Mall ninja.
Okay, good. That was mall ninja or real ninja. The new game we will never play again.
Shokasugi.
Real ninja. And mall ninja. Somehow both.
Depending on which movie he's in.
Somehow both.
So it becomes an extension of... See, that's what I love about this particular character is this villain is really fucking unhinged. Mm-hmm. Like, he's actually developed, and they leave all the pieces out for you to kind of put together, but he's this fucked up guy who killed his dad for some reason, feels remorseful about it, and is obsessed with martial arts, and really, really loves the power that he gets going into people's dreams and dominating, and then doesn't have any remorse murdering regular old people.
Yeah.
Like he is a guy who is just broken, and he's the perfect tool for the government to use as an assassin. Mm-hmm. Because he feels so fucking cool. He is big shit of Turd Mountain. He just absolutely loves it and feels really fucking challenged.
And that's what's great about the relationship and the performances outside of the dream world between David Patrick Kelly and Dennis Quaid. Is that physically, as much shit as David Patrick Kelly is talking, Dennis Quaid's a good 2 feet taller than him.
Oh, yeah.
And you know could kick his ass at any moment. But when he goes into the dream, David Patrick Kelly is king shit of Turd Mountain. And that does give him a power. And that's why Snake Man is like 8 feet tall.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's totally a...
It's little man syndrome.
It's little man syndrome in the dream world. And that's really interesting to watch. And I love the back and forth between them in the real world. And as things get ratcheted up, like, it seems like only Dennis Quaid is really picking up on how evil David Patrick Kelly is. And then, of course, you have this government subplot where the president... Now, this is where, again, parallel thinking, 1984, the more I think about it, and this movie was actually kind of a catalyst to get me thinking about how important 1984 was to genre film, and not just because of Ghostbusters. For example, Dreamscape is only the second movie to be released with the PG-13 rating. Because of Temple of Doom, starring also Kate Capshaw, also with a heart being ripped out of a chest. The first movie to be released with a PG-13 rating was Red Dawn, which is the height of Cold War paranoia fiction. This movie's subplot is Christopher Plummer is going to kill the president in his dreams because the president wants to sign a disarmament pact with Russia.
Yeah, and this was something that was very political at the time because Reagan very much wanted to downsize our nuclear arsenal, and people you know, conservatives were deeply troubled by that. And they were very much like, no, we need more nukes, not fewer nukes. And so this idea that this president is being racked every night by nightmares of nuclear apocalypse. Yeah. Now, here's something I wanted to talk about that we haven't talked about yet. The really, really cool, awesome, weird, dated thing about this movie that I love is the effects of the dreams. Because most of the effects of the dreams are shot on green, or what was probably blue screen at the time. Mm-hmm. But they are, you know, you are seeing backgrounds that clearly aren't there.
Oh, for sure.
Like, and you know, like as a seasoned viewer, you're looking at this and you're like, that, like, not only is it, you know, it looks, you, at times there are matte paintings, at times there are these blue screen walls, you know, in the background, but it's also really fucking awesome because, well, it's a dream.
Dream logic.
It's not,
yes.
It's not supposed to look like reality. It's supposed to look off. And the entire dream sequences are always shot like that. Now, sometimes you get a dream sequence like the kid's nightmare with Snake Man, where it's, you know, it's warped and it's shot like a, we were talking about, like, you know, that kind of TV of the 80s. But the rest of the time, like this post-apocalyptic wasteland that's just bright red and, you know, has a destroyed White House and Congress.
And an oxygen-deprived Schwarzenegger for some reason.
It's, Hey-o,
Quaid.
It looks out of place. It looks nightmarish, but it also looks really cool. And then yeah. You get these sequences where, you know, when they're running through the train from all the nuclear mutants, that's shot very, very cool. Like it's very much like Midnight Meat Train meets Night of the Living Dead in this in the best way possible.
Train of the Living Dead.
It's pretty fucking great. And they keep going from set piece to set piece, doing just really weird, abnormal things that never look quite right, but always look like a fucked up dream.
And I have to ask you this question and be honest with me. Did you incept me before this show? Because literally, I had that exact same thought as I was watching it, which was, this is the one movie that can get away with the effects being dated.
Yeah.
Because every time you see that, you also have to remember that they're in a dream. And if you remember any of the imagery from your dreams, shit don't look right. Shit never looks right in a dream. And when you're in that moment, that's my favorite thing about dreaming sometimes is those few dreams, because it's not every dream. In fact, it's the exception and not the rule, where you can, in your dream, go, I am dreaming. Because so often... Lucid dreaming. You accept the logic of your dreams immediately. And that's, to me, that's the scariest part of nightmares. It's like, I start thinking about them when I wake up, and I'm like, well, why didn't I notice that the pool water was floating 10 feet above the pool in a perfect rectangle? Why did that not faze me at the time? It's because you accept the logic of the dream. So to me, every dated effect in this movie is in a dream sequence, and it's like, you can totally buy that that's what it would look like.
Yeah, see, you're asking if I incepted you. You're not out of the dream yet.
Son of a bitch!
See, the logic that the Phantom would somehow be our most listened to episode?
Fuck.
You just bought it. You believed it.
And why didn't I didn't even ask why Joseph Gordon-Levitt was playing the Phantom in this world. Like, it didn't even occur to me. That is a sharp vest that he is wearing, and those stairs go to nowhere, and it is the Phantom, and it should have clicked for me, but I did not see it.
Bwong.
And also starring Hans Zimmer.
You know, the thing is there's actually a button online. If you look up Inception button, it still exists. It's literally just a big red button that you press that goes, bwong. And it's one of my guilty pleasures every once in a while.
We're going to keep recording this, and I'm going to pretend I'm not looking for it right now.
You could just pretend that you're not looking for the Inception button.
I'm not.
You
could
just pretend. Is that what's happening in your dream right now?
Yeah, that's what's happening. In my dreams, I have so little professionalism when I'm recording that I can literally just look for Inception buttons in the middle of a show. But luckily, you accept the logic of the dream. What were we talking about?
Man, Inception wouldn't exist without this movie.
It really wouldn't.
It's because it, very much of what they play around with is Dreamscape. And the thing is, if you remade Dreamscape today, so many people would be like, dude, this is just a rip off of Inception. Inception. It's like, no, my friend, beat it to the punch by almost 30 years.
Damn it.
You, I love
damn it.
You tried so hard.
Damn it. Nothing works. The dream is broken. Everyone out. Everyone out.
Everyone out of the dream.
Adult dream. Everyone out.
But so this, everything, every moving part in this movie works. You know, we haven't mentioned yet an interesting side bit that also has another parallel to a later movie. So at some point, he's in the village pub. And how do you know it's the village pub?
It's branded across a very attractive billboard. And by billboard, I mean set of breasts.
And then you see it like all over the bar. Like there's shots where they have these big glass things where they're selling t-shirts to the village bar and everybody's wearing the village bar.
Hey guys, if you ever wondered what a production designer does, watch him fail at it in Dreamscape at times and you'll really get a sense of it.
It's kind of amazing. But so they're in the village pub and then Norm shows up. George fucking Wendt shows up, and George Wendt is our conspiracy theory character. He's the character that shows up to share the conspiracy theory, and then when our protagonist finally realizes there is a conspiracy theory and comes back, he goes, "I know, right?" And then he gets killed.
That's the best part, is he's only in three scenes and two of them are in a bar and the third one is when he's getting killed.
But here's what's interesting is when he introduces himself, Dennis Quaid's like, "You look familiar." And he goes, "Oh, hey, I might have one of my books lying around in my satchel." And he pulls his own book.
This is Cargill pretending he doesn't do the exact same thing.
He pulls the book out of the satchel and he turns it over and there's a picture of George Wendt on the back. And he's a horror writer.
So which one?
Well,
which one do you think the movie's making fun of?
Well, I mean, clearly, you know, at this point, it's probably a reference to Kuntz or King.
That's what I'm saying. Which one do you think this movie is accusing of being a conspiracy nut?
Probably more of Kuntz.
You think?
Yeah.
Okay.
But either way, the parallel I was going to bring up was 2 years later, George Wendt would be in a little movie called House. In which he lives next door to a horror writer that is very much like the same kind of level that George Wendt played in the other one and is, of course, geeking out about it. I kind of love the dichotomy of in these two great, horror movies of the mid-80s. George Wendt plays both the star horror writer that's recognized by somebody and the guy who recognizes the neighbor, the horror writer. And I just found it an interesting parallel because there's so many just weird parallels that this movie has with so many other fucking movies.
And I must commend you. Never has the expression little movie called been more appropriate than when you're talking about the movie House. That is a little movie. is a very, like, more people know its sequel than they know House.
Yeah, and House 2 is terrible.
Of course,
like,
it
it's
is.
Unwatchably terrible. Like, it's a movie I tried. I showed my wife both movies back to back one night, and
because you hate her apparently.
Well, no, because House
did she
is
do
great,
to you?
And we kept drinking and drinking, trying to make House 2 better. And and see, the thing is because here's what's really great about House and House 2, because for their horror comedies, House has George Wendt and House 2 has Ratzenberger. So,
there you go.
The series has dueling members of Cheers who are best friends on Cheers. But you see, so George Wendt is like here for a hot minute. And like every time I watch the movie three times in the last few weeks and I always forget George Wendt is in it until he shows back up. It's like, oh yeah. How many scenes until he dies? He's almost dead already.
Oh, the worst part is in the first House when Shelley Long disappears a third of the way through the movie because she thinks she's better than it. And then she comes back later. Hey-o.
Deep cut.
Deep cut Cheers references where everybody knows my reference.
Oh, and as a brief aside, can we talk about how amazing this fucking poster is?
Yes, we can, because this entire podcast has been a series of brief asides, so take it away.
Yeah, no, this is one of those great 80s posters that is so... I'm pretty sure it's Drew Struzan.
It's absolutely Drew Struzan.
Like, it just looks like Drew Struzan. And it's one of those movies that you look at the poster and the poster is selling a very different movie than what it delivers.
As every good cult and exploitation film poster should do in the first place.
But it never lies. Like, that's the thing.
True.
Is it just the way it presents the information, it makes it look like it's a big adventure movie. And it's like, no, it's not. But it looks so badass. And if you go through the history of the DVD releases of this thing, it has some of the shittiest DVD covers you have ever fucking seen. Like, stuff that looks like it was pulled off someone's MySpace in 2003, like really, really shitty stuff, when there was this amazing poster there, because either they didn't have the rights for the poster or because they were like, it's 2003. You don't need a fucking 1984 poster. But that poster is fucking beautiful.
Hey, Cargill, who also did the poster for Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom?
Drew Struzan.
That's really interesting.
Kate Capshaw's favorite artist, maybe? I don't know.
It'd be funny if she said that instead of Steven Spielberg. But yeah, it's funny to me because there's a lot of similarities with this poster to an Indiana. Like, he's literally standing in a leather jacket and like a beige shirt holding a torch.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait. Is this Indiana Jones and the Temple of Dreams? Is that what we're entering right now? I guess we are.
But the cool thing about that poster is if you follow up that doorway type thing, there's all this great imagery from the movie. Like,
and the Snake Man, it incorporates this, like, the weird rickety Escher stairwell,
yeah,
into like the body of the Snake Man. It's actually a really, like, if that were a Mondo poster, like, it would make even more sense because it's got all these sort of extra artistic flares going on. It's not just a piece of marketing. It's Struzan. So it's a work of fucking art. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And so we build up to this showdown in the dream. Of course, we have David Patrick Kelly being a mall ninja. We have the irradiated mutants. There's just so much going on.
We have possessed devil dogs.
Yes.
We've got random electricity.
Preach.
We've got, you know, this crazed underground nuclear irradiated subway. Mm-hmm. And then we get Snake Man again.
Snake Man, who, by the way, kind of looks, I'm pretty sure there is a Mega Man villain who this is modeled and named after, or would
the other way around.
The other way around. Because, you know, the first time I saw him, I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a Mega Man villain. But no, it's David. It's as the Wikipedia entry for Dreamscape.
Wikipedia. It's shake and bake, and I helped.
Earnhardt. So it has a picture of David Patrick Kelly, and the caption says, I shit you not, Tommy Ray Glattman, Dream Assassin. Like, that's on his fucking business card or something. Like, he just hands it out like, ooh, it's upraised on bone-colored stock. Okay,
that's what we needed. We needed a Dokken song in the 80s called Dream Assassin.
Oh, my God. Can we get Dokken now to do a song called Dream Assassin?
Probably.
Hey, hold on. Let me see. I'm going to look up. Hey, I'm not doing it again on the podcast. I know we're still recording. I might be looking up Dokken's phone. Oh, I found it. Wow, that was really quick. Okay, that worked a lot better than the button. But yeah, this is a movie that has a lot of parallels to other things that came out sometimes in the same year. It has a ridiculous cast.
And it's got a couple of really good chase sequences in the real world as well.
Yeah.
Like, we actually, like, Dennis Quaid spends a lot of time running around a racetrack.
He really does.
Like, he opens up with a chase at the racetrack, then when he's being chased, he runs to the racetrack, and then has this really cool chase where the CIA, or the covert ops group that is run by Christopher Plummer, is trying to wipe him out, and he ends up getting the mob guys to back him up. Which is, it does one of those things that I really love, where it has this set piece early on and then it brings that set piece back in. The only way it could have been any better is if, rather than ending on the train like the movie does, we kind of bookend that, where he gives him his winners but kind of screws him over in his own way, or does him right, or some kind of interesting moment there that we just don't get. But yeah, it puts all these threads together, it keeps pulling them, and then we keep having interesting set piece after interesting set piece for a movie that conceptually mostly takes place at a university. It's got a lot of going on and never gets fucking boring.
Yeah, that is absolutely the case. It creates these really interesting characters, because even Kate Capshaw, who I give a lot of shit because of Temple of Doom, and she made that movie very hard to watch for me for many years, is very, like, she's a real person in this movie. Like, she's not some squealing caricature. Like, she's this scientist who is resisting her attraction to Dennis Quaid
Has good reasons for it.
For the good of the project.
The good of the project, and the fact that Dennis Quaid is a sleaze.
Such a sleaze.
And we learn he's a sleaze
because
at the beginning
the 80s,
of the movie.
How do you learn that he's a sleaze?
On his answering machine.
What is that? Can you explain to me what the fuck that is?
An answering machine is a big box that's like your cell phone, only you can't get texts on it.
And people just used it.
They just used
like it was a useful
thing. You would just call somebody's house and this audio cassette would start playing and everybody would say something really cute on it to make people laugh the first 12 times they heard it. And then it would record your voice.
So Grandpa, what you're saying is that at one point in history, you had to be home to get calls?
Yeah. You had to wait by the phone, motherfucker.
Wow. Man, the Dark Ages were weird.
The Dark Ages were really super weird.
Highly recommend this movie, especially as a double feature with any of the movies that have that sort of either unintentional or completely intentional parallel thinking going on.
There's a lot of movies that you could pair it with, particularly movies from this month. Although I would say if you were going to double feature this movie, double feature it with Dream Warriors.
That would be rad.
Like, just watch this and then go from this into Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, and just assume that what they're doing is an extension of the research from Dreamscape and just kind of assume that it's the same universe.
Like, maybe it's 3 years later, that big project got shut down, but some psychologist, like, was reading about it and decided to kind of do his own
version. Use the research and
use the research and then use as a guinea pig pool all the kids at this as his facility to see if any of them might be psychic, and he comes across Heather Langenkamp. No, I see it. I can totally see how that works. That brings us to the junk food pairing, I gotta say it. In this movie, I kept thinking for the number of times that they say the word dream, and it made me really crave one.
Dreamsicle.
Dreamsicle.
Gotta be a dreamsicle.
Incidentally, that...
Or a dreamsicle shake if you have an Alamo Drafthouse nearby.
Oh, fuck yes, a dreamsicle shake. Are you kidding me? Because when you mix it in there and it's kind of that parfait weird orangey color, it looks like the background of every sky and every dream of this movie.
Yes.
So it works on a couple of different levels, much like Inception. It is Shakeception and is so good. Definitely get yourself a Dreamsicle shake. Yes, thank you guys so much for joining us for the first installment of March Madness. We will be back next week with...
We hadn't said Creepers. Let's do Phenomena, a.k.a. Creepers. We'll talk about both versions. We will argue why one may be better than the other or why they're both worthwhile.
So tune in next week when we'll be the only thing on the internet making that argument. Like, even if the internet had existed when that movie came out, I don't think anyone would have talked about it. But that is why we're here. That is why you have Junk Food Cinema, to say the things that no one else will, because they don't care. But if you would like to join us again, find our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Don't forget to become a patron if you haven't, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Lots of great stuff for the patrons, and it's how we keep the lights on here, so we really appreciate your support. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on the Twitters at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
And you can get Doctor Strange on Blu-ray right now.
Oh, yeah. Doctor Strange is out on Blu-ray now. It came out last week and came out just this week in the UK. So if you want Doctor Strange, you have no excuse anymore.
Absolutely. I like how you looked at me when you said that. You have no excuse.
You have no excuse anymore, Brian.
Look, I have seen it now.
It was at the IMAX with laser projection, motherfucker. You missed it.
With laser projection?
Have you not seen the new IMAX laser projection?
That sounds made up.
No,
I'm sorry. That sounds like something you have to avoid to steal the diamonds once the museum is closed.
No, what it is it allows them to project colors so bright that that when you wear the glasses, it looks as bright as watching any other...
Any other
2D movie.
That's been my complaint about 3D for so long that it's too dark.
And they've got the new laser projection system, and it's fucking killer.
I will have to see more movies in Laser Floyd. That sounds great. That is going to do it for this week's episode. So until next week, just remember to stay awake and stay alive and avoid mall ninjas. By the way, I actually found the Inception app, and it's not just a button that makes the noise as I thought it was going to be. It literally says, I shit you not, warning, this app uses your headset to induce dreams through augmented sound. I feel like the minute I try that, that's all of the cancer immediately, right?